This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Brian is the author of many books, including Beyond the Blue Horizon, Elixir, The Little Ice Age, the Los Angeles Times bestseller Cro-Magnon, and the New York Times bestseller The Great Warming. He has decades of experience at sea and is the author of several titles for sailors, including the widely praised Cruising Guide to Central and Southern California. Brian Fagan is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels, published in 2013. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
What led you to write your book, The Attacking Ocean?
This was a rather strange experience. I went to a conference called the Aspen Environmental Forum at that town of that name. And they had all sorts of people there. And one of the speakers was a retired major general from Bangladesh who gave this superb half an hour talk on sea levels, rising sea levels and their impact on Bangladesh, which is about 38 feet above sea level. It's a big estuary, basically. And millions of people are endangered by rising sea levels and by contamination of groundwater, and also by sea surges, which of course result from tropical cyclones and hurricanes. And he told us that they will have to move millions of people as environmental refugees, probably within half a century, whether they like to or not. And there's nowhere for them to go, because India doesn't like them and Myanmar doesn't want them. And I listened to this talk and then said to myself, what's the history of sea levels? Started digging into it, and here I am.
What causes sea levels to rise and fall?
If you look at sea levels over the long haul, and the one thing people don't do with climate change is look at it in the long haul. They all go into hysterics about the human impact of climate change, which is something we should be extremely concerned about. That's not the issue. But in fact, there have been major fluctuations in global temperature and in ice sheet coverage in the world over the last at least 750,000 years, longer than that. And 18,000 years ago, huge areas of Scandinavia were covered by a large ice sheet, the Alps were melted, and most of Canada was covered by two enormous, huge ice sheets. And then, as they melted, enormous quantities of fresh water were deposited in the ocean. And at the same time, you also got adjustments in the Earth's crust, and the sea level has risen 300 feet since the end of the Ice Age.
Would you say more about the rise and fall of sea levels over time?
If you look at them, people think, and the media kind of push the idea that sea levels rise and fall as if it was a flood. It's a very, very gradual and irregular process. And the other thing people don't realize is that the rate of sea level change can be different from one place for another, literally between Puget Sound and, say, Anchorage, because of different topography, earth movements, adjustments of the crust, and so on. And then there's another factor, too, and that is that sea levels rise effectively, imperceptibly most of the time, I mean, a centimeter or two a year. But the effect is not only vertical, it's horizontal. And if you look at, say, some of the flats in the Puget Sound area, you're going to find there's a much broader spread of water with even a teeny raise in sea levels affected by high tides horizontally than there is vertically very often. And this is a thing that people are beginning to realize and worry about.
How do we know about changes in sea levels in the past? What is the evidence?
The evidence is extremely complex. This is an area of study which involves all sorts of different scientists. A great deal of it is done by looking at geological traces on the land, looking at raised beaches where former sea levels way above today's sea levels from way, way back, a million years or so. They also do it by looking at estuaries and rivers. They also do it by looking at satellite measurements and things like that. And it's measured in all sorts of different ways. And now, although we don't know as much as we'd like about ancient sea level rise, our monitoring of today's sea level rise is far more precise.
Historically, what prompted human cultures to form settlements on the coast?
One word, fish. Basically, it's much more complex than that, obviously. And if I may give you an example, What people don't realize is that the North Sea between Britain and the Low Countries was dry land 10,000 years ago until about 5500 BC, and it flooded over this 5,000 or more year period. And this flooding happened in a lowland area. This was marshy, a lot of it was salt marshes and so on. And this was a paradise for people who were hunters and foragers and fisher folk. And one of the reasons people are attracted to water is not only drinking, but it is the abundance of wildfowl, game, plant foods, and fish, and shellfish. And we think that the North Sea area was inhabited by a few thousand people, small bands who moved, but they had lots of food, and if they could, they stayed in one place for quite a while. But the sea level change horizontally was very dramatic, and in places, you literally would be born with one seashore, and when you died, and of course you didn't live much longer than 25 years, the seashore was different, because the topography was changing as the sea was inexorably rising.
Would you say more about the threats coastal communities face from the sea?
The threats that coastal communities face from the sea have changed fundamentally over the last 10,000 years. As I told, with the North Sea, or Doggerland, as the geologists call it, the people just ebbed and flowed, as it were, with the ocean. They could move. They probably had no more than a couple of dozen possessions, because their whole lives were pursuing animals and fish. Then you get villages and towns. And until quite recently, it was possible for them to shift. But today, we live with millions and millions of people living right on the ocean. I believe 38% of the North American population of the United States lives close to the ocean. You've got crowding. You've got multi-million people cities there, mega cities, L.A., Miami Beach, New York. And we are extremely vulnerable to a number of things. One is straight sea level rise. The second one is, and this is actually far more immediate and more important, in a warming world where the experts are forecasting more extreme weather events, tropical cyclones, hurricanes, and so on. If you get one of these sea surges coinciding with a storm and with high tide, the effect of these is a sea surge which will cause the sea level to rise locally several feet, and this will cascade inshore and destroy houses on the beach or do a lot of damage. And this is what happened with Superstorm Sandy, for example. So we are extremely vulnerable, and what can we do about it is a question that's now being debated quite heavily.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of the book, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you give an example or two from the past of societies affected by rising sea levels and how they responded?
This is a fascinating question because really, again, we don't know an enormous amount. You've got the city of Lothal in India, which is a port. It was on the west coast of India, south of the Indus River, which of course was the center of a major civilization 2,000 years ago. And that city was a major harbor. It had the first artificial harbor with a lock in the world. Because one of the reasons people live on the coast, of course, is port trade. And this was a trading city. And then about 2000 BC, and we really don't know a great deal about this, and tropical cyclones are rare in this area of the Indian Ocean. Oddly enough, they had one in the 1990s, which cascaded into the Gulf and did damage in the Gulf states. But about 2000 years ago, one of these sea surges came in, may have coincided with a monsoon flood, and wiped the city out. And today, the site of Lothal is a long way from the ocean because the river which provided access to the city silted up because of rising sea levels and because of sea surges. That's the most dramatic example. There are other examples. There's a city or a town on the eastern coast of England called Dunwich, which was a major port. It rivaled London back in early medieval times, say around 1200. Then about 1400, there was a major sea surge and storm, and now the town lies below sea level. And they've just reconstructed the city plan using remote sensing and divers, which is very difficult because the visibility is low. I can go on giving you examples like that. The site of Homeric Troy has completely changed. The site of Piraeus, the port of Athens, has completely changed as well. There are all sorts of examples.
What are some of the approaches societies have taken to defend themselves from rising sea levels?
Really, the options are very, very limited. The first one, obviously, is to move. And I'm going to kind of put in today here, too. Here you have a question. Do you pass zoning laws that force development to only be 50 foot above sea level, not below? Another way beyond moving is walling yourself in, building seawalls. And this is, of course, what the Netherlands have done with great brilliance and at vast, vast expense. And the initial reaction to much sea level rise today is build seawalls. But in an era where we have all sorts of elaborate bureaucracies protecting the coast, we have powerful development interests. We have a situation where it doesn't seem urgent to many people. And we have an era where people want minimalist government. It's difficult because, let us be blunt and say, this is extremely expensive whether you do it at the federal or the state level. And it's going to involve investments by the taxpayer, which aren't necessarily for you and me, therefore our great-grandchildren. And this is very hard for people preoccupied with election cycles to understand. Then, of course, there's the other one, which is to restore, and people actually used it, but they didn't restore it, is to restore natural coastal defenses, mangrove swamps, wetlands, and things like that, which were a huge protection for early cities, say, in Mesopotamia or Egypt. They're now gone.
How much is sea level rising at present?
It varies infinitely. Nobody really can give you a precise figure. A common estimate for California is a foot between now and 2100, which is a fairly widely accepted estimate. But it varies locally. The San Francisco Bay Area may have one figure. Seattle may have another. A figure of 3 or 4 inches is pretty conservative.
Looking at the rise in ocean levels that we're seeing now, what is the primary underlying cause of that rise?
The cause of the rise ultimately, primarily, is our release of fossil fuels into the atmosphere, and this is triggering global warming and melting. That's a very simple reply, but that basically is it is the interference by humans in the world. We are, as a global community now, faced for one of the first times the really, really urgent global problem, not just an American problem or a Chinese problem, a global problem. And the issue is one word, the sustainability of our society on Earth.
And if you look into the future still further, how much sea level rise is there likely to be?
We don't know, because warming is continuing, and theoretically it could go on till all the ice sheets melt, 30, 40 feet, maybe more, we don't know.
How much threat is there currently to coastal communities?
There's more than people realize. And in a way, this is a ticking bomb. And it really depends where you're talking about. If you're talking about Bangladesh, tens of millions of people are at risk. Many of these people are subsistence farmers who've been anchored to that land for generations. If they lose their land, where are they going to go? That is a huge problem because it's going to involve environmental refugees. There are no international policies for such refugees. Another case is the Egyptian Delta. There is a unsustainable system with mushrooming population growth, which is what you've got in Bangladesh too. How do you adjust to a situation where storm surges are going to take land away, rising sea level is? As a virtual certainty, there's going to be famine in parts of Egypt within 50 years because of the Delta being flooded and the groundwater being polluted by salt water, by rising sea levels. And of course, then you have another factor, which is the case of Shanghai, where you have colossal construction. It's almost unbelievable. And also at the same time, sucking water out of the ground water. And the city is subsiding. And there isn't the silt built up coming down the Yangtze because of the Three Gorges situation. And then you've got rising sea levels. And you put all that together, you've got an extremely dangerous situation. In the United States, the east and south coasts are really ticking bombs because we've had two wake-up calls, Katrina and Sandy. Sandy did over $60 billion worth of damage, much of it in sea surges. And it's a matter of time till a Category 5 comes ashore. And then the damage will be unimaginable. And the options are, do we protect ourselves? Do we move people? Or do we simply smile and pay for the damage? Which brings in the issue of insurance companies, among other things. So it's very complex.
How many people worldwide are likely to be affected by the rising sea?
Hundreds of millions in the long haul. I believe a figure of 200 million people has been quoted at me, but I don't believe you can give an exact figure. If you say tens of millions, you're pretty close to the ballpark.
Would you say more about how the United States is likely to be affected?
The United States is going to be affected in a number of ways. The most pressing one is the potential damage from a higher incidence of extreme weather events, hurricanes in particular. And as I said, Sandy was a wake-up call. The damage from these in areas where now millions of people live is potentially unimaginable. And this means we've got to have really good emergency management by the federal and state government. And actually, Sandy was handled politically extremely well by the governor and the president, even though they were different in political parties. They just got on with the job and are still doing it. And clearly, we've got to address the issue of our vulnerability. What we have got in our favor is a much better ability to forecast hurricanes and other extreme events than we used to have, like El Niños. You get a major El Niño on the West Coast. Down in Southern California, we get storms and floods which just aren't part of our normal lives. And there again, the damage potential is enormous. So there's a lot of risk. The other interesting one, if I may just close this question off, is the San Francisco Bay Area, because there, in the Ice Age, with sea levels much lower, the Golden Gate was gorge. Then as the sea levels rose, it filled the bay, it became an estuary, and there were huge flats, many of which have been filled in. Now, if you get rising sea levels, i.e. equinoctial high tide, and a severe storm all happening at the same time, and sea levels are higher, you're going to get flooding. Can you imagine what will happen if San Francisco Airport is flooded, not for a day, but for 2 or 3 months, because there is not the gradient for the runoff? And these are the sort of scenarios people are beginning to look seriously at, because they're in the future.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of the book, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. What have been the successes and challenges in the development of sea defenses in the Netherlands over time?
The Netherlands is an absolutely fascinating, very praiseworthy example of a society which has been battling the North Sea for over 1,000 years. They had a whole series of very violent gales in medieval times, one of which, called the Groot Mandrenke in 1362, killed 100,000 people and literally rolled cattle and sheep like ninepins across the landscape and killed tens of thousands of them. And a series of these, and one as recently as 1916 and another in 1953, both of which did severe damage, resulted in the damming of the Zuider Zee and also the building of sea defenses. And now the Netherlands is basically walled off. If you live in a coastal village in the Netherlands, don't think you'll have a view of the North Sea. All you will see is a seawall covered with sheep, because the sheep maintain the glass. And the Dutch government has used timbers. They were eaten by torpedo worms brought in by ships from the tropics. Then they changed to stone, which they had to import. Now they use concrete, they use all sorts of medium, because they're doing two things. One is walling off, and the second one is steering the breakers. And also now they're looking very heavily at the drainage of rivers like the Rhine. And this is immensely expensive, and they can afford it, but at a cost to the taxpayer. And they're constantly evaluating. They really looked at Katrina very closely, even more closely than we did, I think. And now they're planning not for a 100-year storm, but for 1,000-year storms or even longer. What they're doing is taking the long viewpoint. And the one thing you must do with anything to do with climate change, particularly sea levels, is take a long view.
Would you say more about the comparison between Bangladesh and the Netherlands in terms of their situation in dealing with rising sea levels?
I am but an archaeologist. I tend to deal with the past, but for what it's worth, I'll give you a few thoughts. The Netherlands has a highly developed infrastructure for sea defences. They are the world's leading experts on the subject. They also have the resources to do it and have mastered the geology. When you're talking about Bangladesh, you're talking, as the Major General said, with a country that is one of the poorest in the world, which has a teeming population. It has an extremely tricky political situation. And they do not have the resources to build these huge walls. And what is interesting is that the World Bank at one point suggested that they have a loan of several billion to do this. And the farmers said, no, it'll destroy our lifeway. And the farmers had a point. But also the geology does not really favor building these sort of seawalls. So what they're doing there more, which is extremely praiseworthy, is in developing elaborate evacuation programs using networks of volunteers, which have just been used very successfully this year when a cyclone came through. They're also building buildings on stilts so that they're above any potential sea surge. And then the other thing they're finally going to do, and this will be hard given the development on the coast, they're restoring some of the mangrove swamps, which used to be the natural protection for the coast. And these are the only measures which, for a country which is holding on by its bootstraps, really has at its disposal. And I have a feeling that we're still going to have a refugee problem. And there were no international policies to deal with this yet. And it's a global problem.
Looking over the past and also considering the present, what is the best approach to protect against rising sea levels based on our cumulative experience as humans?
Nobody knows, because there are a number of variables in the equation. One variable is the nature of the local geology, the nature of the threat. For example, in the Netherlands, the stakes are enormous. 45% of the country is at or below sea level, and millions of people live at that level in cities like Amsterdam. On the other hand, the problem in, say, Puget Sound is very different because you are in much more sheltered water, and the issue really probably involves infilled land. If you are looking at the problem in a modern context, you are looking at the protection of the coast. In California, we have coastal commissions, we have power commissions, we have this commission. We have a very intricate jigsaw puzzle of bureaucracies and of commissions, all of whom are producing studies, papers, sometimes giving grants. At the other end are local authorities and people who own houses and businesses. And how one is going to navigate this and do meaningful things is a local problem and very complex. And I think one of the things we're going to have to realize that at one end of the scale, you're going to have an issue like, how do you wall off or deal with New York? And Bloomberg, Mayor Bloomberg, has produced an extremely well thought out plan, but this will now be attacked by vested interests, by bureaucrats. There are complex social problems. Are the poor being protected, or is it just Wall Street? It's going to take years to build this. And money there isn't necessarily the problem. It really is a local problem, and it comes down to people, how much they want the government to get involved, and the local situation. It's an elaborate equation that we really haven't brought down to a level where common folk like you and I can get a grip on it, because it's very intricate, and just the legal entanglements of this are potentially worse than those around water in the West, and those are something else. So we're at an early stage.
What steps are being taken in the developing world to deal with sea level rise?
Now you get into a very complex and fascinating issue, because you've got, above all, the issue of Pacific Islands and communities on barrier islands like those in Alaska. The Pacific Islands and the Maldives, for example, face absolutely brutal future, because if projections are correct, some island communities are going to vanish. And here you're dead up against an issue. In Maldives, for example, Japanese development money walled off the capital. But the capital is subsiding because of intensive building, among other things. Do the Maldives have a future? We don't know. Tuvalu and Kiribati in the Pacific definitely have a problem. What do you do? The only thing you can do ultimately, and they've talked about building oil rig-like settlements, which of course is too expensive, is to move. Where do you move them? Does New Zealand want them? They're going to take some. I think it's Tuvalu, which has got an island in Fiji, which it has been either bought or taken over. But it's going to have to face out migration. But the scale of that is, on a global scale, small compared with that of, say, Bangladesh. The island community nations have formed organizations to try and make their case more prominent in the United Nations and so on. But in the long run, all of us, wherever we are, and I hate to say this, we're on our own. And it's the local initiatives that will work.
What lessons can we take from the past to help guide us in the future in regard to rising sea?
That's an interesting question to answer, because the answer is complex. Because we live in a world that is unimaginably different from the world of even 1850. Why? Because of population growth, fossil fuels, industrial revolution, and the huge growth of cities and communications and all that. But there's one thing we can learn from the past, and this may seem very theoretical, but it actually isn't. And that is the fact that ever since sea levels have risen, we've been the same. We're Homo sapiens. We're the wise people. We think, we plan, we love, we hate, we quarrel, we negotiate. And in the end, we come up with solutions. And I think the lesson of history is that ultimately we will rise to this challenge. But other challenges we've witnessed very often have had a high cost in human lives, in social disruption. There is going to be, in the future, conflict. There is going to be huge casualty losses. Just look at the losses from the famine in Ethiopia, which barely hit the headlines. And we are really going to be, in the developed world, confronted with the developing world head on, because it's going to be closer and many of the crises there will impact on us. And the lesson is that human nature has not changed. And therefore, I think you need to look at the history of climate in human terms and the future of climate in human terms, not in bureaucratic terms, not in ideological terms, but in terms of how we as human beings are going to solve these problems. And that to me is a very important lesson. I've done quite a lot of talking to emergency preparedness groups, and the first time I was asked to talk to them about the history of emergencies, I said, huh? And they said, we think human nature probably hasn't changed. How did people react? When I got into this, it was absolutely fascinating, because we haven't changed. We still have fears. We still have ambitions. And with sea levels, we're going to have fears and ambitions too.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
A number of them, some of which may seem silly. One, conserve water and do not leave the faucet running while you brush your teeth. Conserving water is terribly important. Number two, if you're going to buy a property right on the ocean, think first, because something that may happen as sea levels rise and there's more destruction is that the forces of the marketplace may cause prices to go down. And if you're buying houses, and I hope you are, for your children and grandchildren, get them at least 50 foot above the sea level. But above all, live sustainably and responsibly with the earth. And that's something that sounds wildly theoretical, but it actually isn't. And sea levels are a good example.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
You were just listening to Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of the book, The Attacking Ocean: The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels, published in 2013 by Bloomsbury Press. For more information, check on the web at brianfagan.com. Again, that's brianfagan.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.